When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. A very warm welcome back once more to the Tap and Go. It's great to have you here this week. As I mentioned last week, we have something else a little bit different today. Today, we're joined by someone who has the job which every 10-year-old boy dreams of, the job that every person who turns their TV on at 3 p.m. on a Saturday afternoon to watch the goals go in thinks they will be good at. He is lucky enough to travel around the country watching some of the finest teams play. He is one of Soccer Saturday's finest. It's Mr. Mark McAdam. So sit back and relax, and hopefully we can get this out of the way before Leicester and Palace kick off in half an hour. Mark, thank you so much for joining us. I mean, how are you?
Yeah, very good, thank you. I'm just in the middle of a busy period of time. It feels like every season at the moment is mad busy, and particularly this season with the World Cup sandwiched for 6 weeks in the middle of a busy football campaign already, it just means that you're Saturday, Tuesday, and you don't get 5 minutes to stop and think and reflect, and just you're just on to the next thing. So, yeah, no, it's all good. No complaints at all. Best job in the world.
Yeah, no, it's definitely the best job in the world. Yeah, I'm very grateful that you've managed to give up half an hour to come speak. And yeah, as you said, you've been away from home for 10 days now, and it's sort of, you know, we're very grateful to have you on. So might as well start with what you just mentioned. Obviously, the World Cup's coming up. Obviously, it's been one of the more controversial World Cups in the past. What are your sort of general takes on it? Are you excited for it, or are you a bit apprehensive with everything that's sort of been surrounding it, all the politics and everything like that?
I'm excited for the football because it is truly one of the most spectacular sporting events in the world, and it only happens every 4 years. So to see the teams going toe-to-toe on the pitch, I cannot wait for. It's something I'm super excited about. Of course, I have a few reservations about things off the field. The human rights record of Qatar, the way that LGBTQ plus people are treated. And of course, just generally the way they were awarded the World Cup, perhaps. You know, it leaves you just with a few questions. But it is what it is. It is in Qatar. And let's use this as an opportunity to show the Qatari people and, of course, the people that are responsible for the World Cup that this, you know, this is the best sport in the world. And football is truly a global language. And let's use this as an opportunity to showcase that regardless of your gender, your sexuality, your religion, where you come from, what you believe in, you should be allowed to go and watch football and support your team, loved and supported for whatever you are. We're all one race, and that's the race. So, yeah, maybe it's an opportunity to kind of let them know that things that right and shouldn't be done in certain ways, but also, you know, let's think about that and use this opportunity and get excited about football, because that's, you know, what we're all there for at the end of the day.
No, very well said. And obviously, so looking at the football, what are your sort of early predictions on what's going to happen?
I think it's going to be interesting, isn't it? Because you know, you just know that the South American sides will be good. Argentina and Brazil will be there or thereabouts. You know that Germany, France will be strong. You know, there's a secret compartment in your brain that thinks England might be okay, despite their recent form, which obviously hasn't been great and has left a lot to be desired. So, you know, it's one of those things. And then even, you know, one of the Asian sides or one of the African sides will probably surprise a few. So I think that's the great thing about the World Cup is that, you know, you've got this collection of football culture and heritage from everywhere in the world coming together. And at the end of the day, as we've seen on the big stages and the big tournaments, it's not always about which team has the best players on paper. It's about the team that's the best team. So I think, you know, it'd be brilliant. And I think I can enjoy it. And it'd be very different, of course. You know, we're not going to be sat in beer gardens wearing shorts and vests and, you know, chucking beer in the air. We'll be sat like five layers deep, chucking a hot chocolate in the air. So it's going to be a very different type of World Cup for us. It's condensed as well, which means there's four games a day as opposed to three games. So that's obviously going to have a bit of an effect on things. So literally it's going to be wall-to-wall live football for the first two and a bit weeks. So that'll be brilliant at a time where everyone's quite jovial anyway because it's Christmas. So, yeah, it's going to be fascinating. I can't wait to see how it plays out. And, of course, the countdown is definitely on now.
So just touch on that point, obviously, with it not being in the summer, do you think that's going to have an effect on the following and sort of the support the World Cup gets? I mean, England fans are nuts anyway, but do you sort of think that because of the kickoff times and everything like that, it might be a little bit less followed than other World Cups previously?
I think it will be followed in the same way, you know, every World Cup will be followed. I remember when the World Cup was in Japan, 2004, maybe something like that, or 2002, I can't quite remember now. You know, I was getting up at 5 a.m. to watch the England games, you know, to support the team. And it would be the same if it was late at night. I think it's one of those things that this is appointment to view football TV, you know, regardless of what time the match is on, people will get up to watch it and support their nation because that's what the World Cup is all about. And the great thing about World Cups from the past is that it draws families together. You know, the wives, the aunties, the daughters, the cousins that perhaps historically wouldn't watch football, wouldn't watch matches. Everyone gets excited for the World Cup and that's what's truly brilliant about it.
I mean, how good a Christmas could it be if England did the unthinkable?
It would literally be the best, wouldn't it? I don't think anyone could dream of a better Christmas than if England won the World Cup. And that's part of the fun of being a football fan, is it's the ability to dream and to get excited about what might happen. And the funny thing is, you know, if, for example, we'd won a couple of Nations League matches and played reasonably well recently, I think everyone would be going, right, we got to the final of the Euros. We got to the semi-final of the last World Cup. Now, surely this is our time. This is Gareth's time. This is Harry Kane's time to stand up and go all the way. But because of recent form, everyone's expectations have been tapered a little bit. So they're not quite as perhaps enthusiastic or as optimistic as they would have been. So I think it's one of those situations that, you know, I think it will be good. It will be exciting. And I'm looking forward to seeing how it unfolds. But I do think, you know, the whole thing's going to be very different.
Mm. Do England, I mean, obviously, as you just spoke about with the Nations League form going the way it has and us finishing bottom of the table for our group. And do you think that's quite a big telltale sign that England probably aren't going to be where they could be for this World Cup? Or do you think, forget Nations League, it's a one-off World Cup, England still very much will compete and should be up and around there as they were 4 years ago?
Yeah, I think they'll be okay. I think it'll be a challenge. I think it'll be tough. I think there'll be some really difficult games. There'll be one or two surprise teams. You have to get a little bit lucky with the draw as well. And of course, you just need to start with the right momentum. And like all big tournaments, you need luck as well. I think, you know, whether it's the draw or whether it's, you know, a refereeing decision, obviously with VAR, that will be, you know, those kind of little elements of luck that either go for you or against you, as we've seen in the past. That hopefully will be eradicated now because of VAR being involved. So I think it's just a collection of different things that you need to go right for you. And I don't think there's a reason. You know, we've got a really experienced manager that's managed on the international stage for a long time. There's a group of players that have worked and played together for a good number of years. There's a nice mix of experience and wise heads with some young flair and some excitement. So I think there's a really nice balance to everything that England have at the minute. I think the one thing that they do actually lack is probably a little bit of self-belief and confidence, which is what they had for the Euros, which is what they had for the World Cup beforehand. So if they can find that between now and the tournament, I think everyone will be happy. But if they get off to a great start, play that first group game, play really well, score goals, keep a clean sheet, then I think, you know, there's no reason why everyone can't be optimistic.
I think you touched on quite a big thing there with the fact that England's players at the moment, and we've got an incredible squad to pick from. There's been a lot of talk about Southgate and how he could potentially be seen to be defensive. Are you sort of in that boat that Southgate, with the players he's got, should be looking to score more goals? Not necessarily. A lot of people say he avoids defeat rather than goes to win games. What's sort of your view on that?
Well, I think generally Gareth's been really successful with what he's done so far. So I think you look at the situation and you go, well, actually, we've done well. We've played well. And, you know, tactics, back three, back four, players. You speak to managers, you speak to coaches, you speak to players, and everyone will have a different viewpoint and perspective about what should be done and what's the right thing to do. And, you know, one manager will say, it's all out attack. That's what I do. That's what I want. And one manager will say, the most important thing to win a football match is to have a clean sheet first and then you go from there. So I think it's getting that balance right. I think we definitely have, you know, when you look at the players we've got in our armoury when it comes to going forward, the likes of Harry Kane, the likes of Raheem Sterling, Phil Foden, Jack Grealish, there's some real quality there that could potentially really damage the opposition. So I think you have to play to those strengths. I think defensively, we are perhaps a little bit weaker on paper. So therefore, you might think, well, actually, Gareth needs to look at things defensively to make sure we're really solid and resolute at the back, because that's possibly our area of weakness. You know, the two centre-halves, maybe not as strong as other sides. So therefore, that's going to be, you know, one of those things. But I think you just have to trust in what Gareth's done. You know, he's earned the right to take this England team to Qatar. What happens after that, everyone can decide after the tournament. But with what he's done over the last 4, 5, 6 years, he absolutely deserves this opportunity on the biggest stage. And I think we just have to trust him. I think he knows what he's doing. He's been there, he's done it, he's got the t-shirt. And, you know, for a bit of luck, we could have been, you know, world champions, and we could have been European champions, you know, fine margins at that level. So yeah, I think it's one of those things. I think we can sort of, you know, we've got some really exciting players, and I think if we just trust in the manager, then we'll be okay. But you know, one game down, two games down, you can change things. You can change tactics during the course of a match. If something's not working, the best managers are those that recognise things and change them immediately. And you see it in the Premier League week in, week out. Those managers that set up one way, after 20 minutes, they change formation, they move a player around, they go to a diamond in the middle, they play a different formation, and things change. And Gareth's got to be switched on to be able to do that during matches. So, I think there is all the ingredients there of a really strong England setup. And perhaps, you know, we can just dream, can't we?
Does he start Maguire?
Well, for me, you don't start Maguire. You know, that's if you're not starting for your club, then you're not in any fit place to start in a World Cup. However, Harry Maguire has always been essentially very good for England. He's never let the side down. He's always played reasonably well. And Gareth Southgate is a very, very loyal manager and coach. And I, you know, it's probably part of the thinking of the recent matches that Harry Maguire played. He's probably thinking, well, I know you've never let me down. You've always done well by me. You've always played well for England. And I don't care if you're not playing for Manchester United. I'm actually going to play you and give you this opportunity to showcase that you're still a top-class defender. Perhaps probably didn't quite work out that way. He didn't have his best matches. But you can sort of see the mindset and the mentality and the thinking behind Gareth Southgate when it came to deciding if Harry Maguire should play. But I think you pick the two most informed players that have got the nicest balance. So, you know, really for centre-halves, if you're playing two at the back, You want someone who's really dominate, can dominate aerially, that can win headers and be a physical presence. And you want someone that's got pace and the ability to play out from the back. So, you know, right now you're probably looking at John Stones and Fikayo Tomori. I've always liked Kyle Walker at centre half as well, because he's strong and he's got pace. So that would be kind of my thinking at the moment. But, you know, I'm not the England manager, so it's one of those things. It doesn't matter what I say.
If you were the England manager, who starts at right wing back and left wing back?
This is a fascinating situation. Trent is, as of this interview, going to be out for the next couple of weeks for Liverpool, and he hasn't played particularly well recently as well. So he looks like he's some distance away from playing for Liverpool and, of course, England. Rhys James has always done well, perhaps more of a physical presence. So he brings a little bit more strength to that defensive unit. I like him. I think Luke Shaw, you know, World Cups are big tournaments where you probably want experience. So I would go with Luke Shaw. He's been there, done it. He's played for Manchester United. He's been around for a while. So I think perhaps he would play at left wing back for me, or left back.
Even though he's in and out of the United team at the moment with Man City?
Yeah. I don't, you know, who else? Ben Chilwell? Who else would you play at left wing back?
Yeah.
I just think he's probably the most rounded player with the most experience. Rhys James would probably be the right back that will get chosen. I've always liked Kieran Trippier. He adds a different dimension as well, because he's got the ability to score goals from free kicks, and of course from free kicks and corners. He's got that magic wand of a right foot that can put things into the box, put quality into the box. So I think he adds that. So it depends, really. Again, you know, if you want to play against a side where you think you're going to have a little bit more of the ball and you can get forward and there's going to be some crucial work down the channels, you might put Trippier in so you can just get that ball in the box. If you want to be a little bit more solid defensively, you might go for Rhys James. But I don't think there's a standout, really, of any of, you know, the back four that you go, right, he is nailed on to play 100%.
Interesting. Well, we'll come back to some of the current like headlines at the moment. I just want to talk about you for a little bit. So obviously you have got, as we've said, the best job in the world. Every 10-year-old dreams of having your job. Can you tell us a little bit how you got into that, and sort of, was it always what you wanted to do?
Yeah, it's funny actually, because I know so many people grow up and they've got this, you know, really challenging moment from the age of 14, 15, 16 to sometimes early 20s, where they go, you know, what do I want to do with my life? What's my career path? What do I want to achieve? Where do I want to work? How do I want to pay my bills? Whereas for me, I knew at the age of 12 years old exactly what I wanted to do. So I was working in a comic shop in Bournemouth, where I grew up. And there were customers that came in quite frequently. And there was one customer that was involved with this local film. And he said, oh, we need actors, we need extras, would you be interested? And I was like, yeah, too right. And this is a young Mark McAdam that had never acted in his life, was shy and timid and quiet, and someone that just had no experience of anything to do with acting and film and TV and all this sort of stuff. But I volunteered to be involved in this production. And as soon as I walked onto the set, and as soon as I met the people involved, and there was this, you know, massive ball of creativity from all these really enthusiastic uni students and film students and people from the industry that had all come together to make this project. And I was just like, you're all getting paid to do this. And from that moment, I was like, I just fell in love with, you know, film and TV and the process of making content. And then straight away, I was like, right, this is what I want to do. So by the age of 12, I decided what college course I was going to do. I just kind of set out on my career path to work in the media. I got an opportunity to do a little bit of work experience when I was about 14, 15 for the local newspaper. I was sending in stories, never got paid for them, but every now and then they'd get printed. And then from that, I left school. I went to college. I was studying multimedia and TV. And then from that, I got an opportunity to work at Bournemouth Football Club. That led on to local radio. That led on to ITV Meridian, which is a local TV channel. And then from there, I went on to Sky Sports. So whilst at the beginning, my path wasn't always sport and football, the opportunities that presented themselves to me were within sport and football. So I was like, just ride the wave, take everything that comes your way, grasp every opportunity, and then just go from there. And then, you know, all these years later, I'm working in football still and TV, and yeah, it's it goes quickly, but yeah, it doesn't feel like that long ago that I started off my journey on this incredible career that I've had so far, and I'm very blessed and lucky to have had the opportunities I've had. But really, it's just hard work and desire, never give up, and keep going, because there were a lot of times when I thought, you know, this industry is too tough to crack and I'm not going to get to where I want to go. So maybe I need to look at other things. But I always sort of got to the point where I was like, well, there's nothing I've ever wanted to do other than this since I was 12 years old. So you just kind of have to keep working hard and hopefully you'll get where you want to go.
So obviously you are working at the Holy Grail of football club, which is Soccer Saturday. Sort of, did you approach Sky? Or was they approach you having seen something you'd done before? How did you sort of get involved with that?
With Sky, I was at ITV Meridian for a number of years. So I had a bit of TV experience. I had a bit of football experience and a few contacts and a little bit of knowledge. And basically all I did was I built a relationship with one of the news editors at Sky. And then every single kind of month, I'd send an email and say, look, I've got this idea. I've got that idea. I've got this story. I've got this interview. And then one time he phoned me up and said, oh, I've just seen your email. I like your idea number three. Yeah, we'll send you a camera and you can do it. And then that went well. And then from there on and so forth. And I just forged relationships, kept working hard, kept trying to prove to them that I was good enough to work in the industry. And then obviously just went from there and ended up freelancing for a big chunk of years before, being there permanently. So, yeah, it was just one of those things. I just kept bugging people, kept sending in ideas, kept being creative, kept suggesting things. And eventually I think I just became so much of a pain that they ended up saying, well, yeah, just give him some jobs just to keep him happy.
And it's clear that you love what you do. Is there sort of anything in particular which sort of like is the best part of the job, or is it just the whole thing is you're happy doing what you do?
Yeah, I love so many elements of the job. There are some amazing things that I get to do and meet some incredible people. I always get a real kick when you meet someone and they say, oh, I really loved that interview you did, or I really loved that series you did, or I really loved that piece you did, or I remember this or I remember that. And when people come up to you, maybe sometimes even years later, and say, oh, that interview was brilliant and I really loved it, and it made me smile and it was great and fantastic, whatever it is, you take some, you know, real satisfaction from enhancing someone's life, you know, whether you're a singer or a comedian or, you know, a sports presenter. If someone can watch your content and watch what you do and enjoy it and remember it, then that's the best thing. That's the most amazing thing. So I'm always sort of super excited about that kind of stuff. And I always feel a great sense of pride when people talk about my work and my ideas and the things that you come up with. So that's always a nice thing. You know, I am up close and personal with some of the most incredible sportsmen and women that have graced the planet. And I get the opportunity to speak to them sometimes just a few moments after they've won a gold medal in the Olympics, or they've won the Premier League title, or they've achieved something that no one else has ever achieved. So, you know, those moments are really special. And, you know, everyone always says, oh, who's the best interview? Who's the most famous person you've met? And I genuinely forget, you know, so many of the people I've met because I had the opportunity to meet so many. You know, I'm Wayne Rooney or Zidane or, you know, Robbie Williams or Samuel L. Jackson or Kylie Minogue, or, you know, Whoopi Goldberg or Jose Mourinho, you know, or someone, you know, that's Helen Glover, who wins an Olympic silver medal but spends years and years of her life dedicated to winning something. There's always there's always someone there that you think, oh yeah, what about this person or that person? Or the time I played snooker with Steve Davis, six times world champion. You kind of forget because you're so lucky that you get to meet these people so much of the time. And I think that's the best thing about the job, is that you're as close to the action as you can possibly be, and as close to those people competing, that you almost feel like sometimes you share that moment and that journey in a small way with them, because you're the first person to ask the question or to be there with the microphone or to get that reaction, good and bad. And that's what makes this industry and sport so precious.
Yeah, I mean, there's awesome, I mean, incredible names you just dropped. But or is this the hardest part of the job?
The hardest part of the job is probably the travel, loads and loads of travel. As I said, when we spoke before the interview, you know, I spent 10 days up north, living out of a suitcase, going to TK Maxx and buying my pants and socks, because I've been away from home for so long. And then one job rolls into another job, which rolls into another job. And you know, one minute you're in Bristol, then you're in Manchester, there's Sheffield and Blackburn, and then you're down to Reading. And then you, so whilst traveling is brilliant and you get to see so many places, you don't get to see places, you just get to go to an event and then you're back on the road and on to the next one. So there's a lot of time on the road. I spent a big chunk of my life dedicating myself to the industry. This isn't really a job that you can just rock in at, do your stuff and go home and switch off. You know, I will sit in bed most nights and watch half an hour's worth of Sky Sports News. I'll read as much as I possibly can. I'll be across everything, you know, whether it's cricket, whether it's rugby, whether it's, you know, the women's national side in America, the Premier League, the EFL. You don't know what's going to present itself to you with regards to work. So you have to be across these things, because you can't just turn up and, you know, blag it. You have to have an element of knowledge, and you have to respect the people that you're in the company of. And that often means you have to live, breathe, sleep, sport. And it's not just a job, it's a lifestyle. And so often you have to dedicate yourself to that. For example, today's football show on Sky Sports News, which I did, you know, I had to watch Monday Night Football. I had to watch both games on Super Sunday, and I had to watch all the highlights from Saturday, because we had a section where we spoke about Wolves, we spoke about Newcastle, we spoke about Arsenal, Liverpool and Bournemouth. We spoke about seven teams in the EFL. We spoke about the Monday Night Football, and there were other elements as well. So you have to be across everything, because at some stage or another, that information and knowledge is going to be needed. So yeah, it's a job you really have to commit to, which means at times you can't always have the nights out and the social activities and the stuff you do with your friends, because, you know, you need to be ready for work. So yeah, like all these things, you know, you speak to any sportsman or woman, you know, did they have to make sacrifices with regards to social activity to achieve the things they did? Absolutely. Is sport and sports broadcasting very similar? Well, if you want to achieve things, you want to be successful and you want to progress, then you do have to dedicate yourself. You can't just turn up at 9 and leave at 5 and think that you're going to be successful.
So I can't resist just having you heard what you just said. Arsenal Liverpool, one, was it a penalty? Two, was it a handball?
I'm so confused. Like, I am so confused with what is a handball, what's not a handball, why things are being given, why VAR is making as many mistakes as it is, why are there not more ex-pros sat in Stockley Park with these VAR referees making decisions with them to help them and guide them? Why are decisions taking so long? You know, it just, I don't know. You know, everyone thought that the talking points would be taken away from football when VAR was introduced. But actually, there's as many talking points as there ever was. And in theory, sometimes actually a bit more, because you are having these debates about what is it. And, you know, and it's just one of those things, I think, yeah, super frustrating for everyone connected. You know, sometimes it goes for you, sometimes it doesn't. But I just know that there are some managers that have got VAR or PGMOL apology letters framed in their office. So, yeah, when you get one of those, we're sorry, we've made a mistake letters, it goes on the wall, and, you know, it's just part of the game, isn't it?
I mean, so I was there, I was at the game on Sunday. Okay. The general feeling in the ground, so I have to admit, I was a Liverpool fan, but sitting in the Arsenal end. And the general
Fan sitting in the Arsenal end.
Yeah, so I know, I was lucky I got gifted a ticket in the Arsenal. But so I was, the general feeling in the ground from the Arsenal fans was that at half time in this other video, it was a handball. And having seen the penalty, it was that was lucky. I think, as you mentioned, the big thing with handballs, especially, is on the Saturday, that handball's given. On the Sunday, it's not. The lack of consistency, I think, is the big issue that needs to be solved. Is that, I mean, I'm pretty much said what you just said.
Absolutely agree.
No, so it's, I think the big thing, I mean, you can't really do it mid-season. They've had, what, 2.5 seasons to sort it now, but they need to sit everyone down in the room and say, look, this is what done, this is what's done, because otherwise the football is just going, it's going, all the good football's being lost in the controversy by the other football. And that's what it's going to ruin the game as it is at the moment. But so anyway, looking back at sort of you, I just was wondering, so a lot of the listeners to this podcast, sort of the 16 to 18, 20-year-old bracket, who are the sort of people looking to get into the sports industry, especially. We've had a lot of guests talk about how they've got their journey. If you had any tips for people trying to break into the media game, what would you say?
Well, things are very different now from when I was a youngster. You know, when I was growing up, you had local radio, you had local TV, and you had national TV, you had local newspapers and all that kind of stuff. And there was a lot of local opportunities. Whereas now they don't really exist. You can't really go to the local newspaper and start doing work experience because most of the time the local newspaper isn't there anymore. The same with local radio. Local radio stations are few and far between now. And so much of the radio comes from, you know, Bristol or Manchester or London. It's sent around the whole country on network. So those opportunities don't exist. But what people have now, which I didn't have, and that's the opportunity to broadcast as we are now from your house. You know, there's YouTube, there's social media, there's podcasts, there is the internet where you can reach billions and trillions of people around the globe. You don't need someone sat in, you know, a TV channel commissioning office to say, we want you to make a program. You don't need a PC from a local radio station to say, we want to give you a radio show between 8 and 10 every Sunday morning. You don't need a newspaper editor to commission you to go and write a story on a news event down the road. You have at your fingertips the opportunity to put stuff out there. So I would say to everyone, you know, make podcasts, make YouTube videos, do interviews, interact on social media, make as much content as you can. Because if I'm making a piece of content for Mark McAdam YouTube, or I'm making a piece of content for Sky Sports that's being shown on Sky Sports News on the busiest day of the week, the process is the same. The only thing that's different is who's viewing it at the other side. There might be 10 people watching on my YouTube, and there might be 10 million people watching Sky Sports, but the process is the same. The interview's the same, the question's the same, the prep's the same, looking at the camera is the same, whether it's a camera in your webcam at home or whether it's a, you know, £25,000 camera from a broadcast cameraman at Sky, you're still looking at a lens, regardless of how expensive that lens is. Everything is the same. So don't worry about at the beginning how many people are watching your YouTube or, you know, what you're doing. Just learn the process. Understand how to craft an interview. Understand how to get really good answers off of someone. Understand how to edit and create and storytell, and to recognize good news lines and to recognize good content. All those things can be done from day one. You know, just teach yourself and learn about the industry and put yourself in those environments and make as much as you possibly can. So that would be always one piece of advice, you know, regardless of where your content is going, just make content. Because I used to, when I worked at the football club at Bournemouth, I used to, you know, make videos, VHS videos, funny enough, and DVDs that used to get sold in the club shop. And we used to sell 100, 150 copies. That was it. And I was rubbish, totally useless and rubbish. But I was acting as a Sky Sports presenter on a VHS video that got sold 127 times to people in and around Bournemouth. But that was my breeding ground. That was my foundation. That was where I learned things. That was where I started to become the person I am now at Sky Sports. You always have to start somewhere, and you always have to start at the beginning. So don't worry about all of that stuff and how many people are watching. Just worry about practicing and learning and developing and, you know, putting all the foundations in place for your skill set to be as varied and as experienced as possible. that's another thing as well. I think, you know, people that come in and just say, oh, I just want to be a presenter, you know, they don't get taken very seriously. Come in and say, right, I want to learn how to do production. I want to learn how to edit. I want to learn how to write scripts. I want to know how to produce a rundown. I want to know about everything in this industry. I want to know about what the production manager does and what happens in the gallery and how the technicians work, and then everything else. And then when you've learned all that, then you can start to think about, oh, right, actually, I still think I want to know how to report and present. But the best reporters and presenters are those people that have done all of the other stuff for years and years and years as well. You know, talking on TV, talking as we are now, is essentially what we're doing now. It's exactly the same. It's the easy bit. It's the glossy, glamorous bit with the profile, and it's the sexy bit. But actually, it's all the other stuff that will contribute to you being a really good broadcaster or presenter, because you understand all the things that are going on behind the scenes, and you understand when things don't go to plan. Because in live TV, a lot of stuff does not go to plan. You know, things don't happen perfectly all the time. You have to use your initiative, and you have to make things happen yourself, and you have to be quick to think about, oh, that's not working, that camera's not working, the auto cue's gone down, the guest isn't ready, my notes have gone, the laptop's frozen. All this stuff, if you know how to do that anyway, because of all the experience you've gained working in production teams, then you'll be so much better as a presenter and reporter, because you've got that big grounded experience where you know how to do every single job within that newsroom, within that channel, or on location. And I think they're really important things, you know, just that get everything, get as much experience as you can, meet as many people as you can, always get phone numbers and emails, because you'll never have too many contacts in this industry. And get as much experience as you can doing everything. And that means just build your social media, interact with people, create TV shows, and do things. And don't worry too much about the quality. Because even now, having worked in this industry for over 20 years, I'm still learning and developing as a presenter. Even today, I looked at a couple of things I did today, and I think that wasn't good enough. I should have done this. I should have done that. You know, you are never a finished, perfect article, and you will keep learning and changing and developing to the very last day you work in this industry. So, don't be afraid to continually learn and develop and try and improve yourself every single day, because this is an industry that moves forward at a rapid pace, and you need to be on the train, and you need to understand the direction you're going, and make sure you adapt and learn as you go.
No, that's great. I think all the listeners who you've said more than I could have ever asked for, and that's about 10 different tips, but yeah. I think
I just tend to talk a lot.
No, that's great. I think hard work and perseverance is sort of the key things that we've learned from.
And enjoy it as well. You have to enjoy it. You know, that's whatever you do in life. The most important thing you do when you get up out of bed every day is smile, laugh and joke and enjoy things. If you don't enjoy this industry, then don't be in it, you know, whatever industry you decide to work in, you have to love it and enjoy it. That's key.
And so obviously one of the pretty bigger moments in your career, and pretty, I hope, one of the main things you're proud of is obviously you came out, I think, in 2014. Was it? Do you just want to tell us a little bit about that and sort of how you came to the decision that you felt comfortable and that how it was received and everything? So obviously, I mean, everyone's an admiration of everyone who comes out because it's such a brave thing to do in the public eye, and especially with footballers. I mean, it's probably more and more common, but from a lot of people's perspective, you still feel like the people aren't comfortable doing it. But obviously you were one of the first people to do it. So do you want to talk a little bit about that?
It was probably one of the most terrifying things I've ever had to do. And one of the most challenging things I think any LGBTQ plus person will have to do in their lifetime is come out. And, you know, it sounds so simple, but it's something that can fill you with fear and dread and can literally keep you awake at night. And in my case, growing up, you know, genuinely felt like I would be better off not being alive than living as a gay man. I was so scared about my sexuality, and it took me a long time to understand it and feel comfortable with it. You know, and sadly, that's, you know, it's not always easy for people. Some young boys and girls can come out at 14, 15 and feel loved and supported and feel totally comfortable within themselves. And some people never come out in their whole lifetime. And some people come out in their 20s and some in their 50s. And it's always difficult because for someone that's never had to go through it and never had to think about their sexuality or never been abused for who they are or who they identify as, it can often feel like this, you know, this insignificant thing that's made into a big deal. But for most people, it will be one of the biggest things they ever do in their life because it can be so haunting and challenging and can damage so much of your young life because you live in fear. For me, I always knew growing up I was gay, but, you know, hid it like most people do and felt, you know, very uncomfortable in my skin and who I was and what I was about. And even really into my early 20s, still, you know, was very unsure of myself. I came out to my friends and family when I was in my early 20s, but didn't feel comfortable enough to come out in football, in the sports industry. So I had two very distinct, different lives. One was me as a gay man and comfortable and happy in that. And then the other was, you know, Mark McAdam working in football and being the macho straight bloke that was involved in that environment. And over time, it became very difficult to live two very separate lives because you become so aware of the language you use, the people you hang around with, who you're seen talking to or who you're seen out with. And you almost create this whole kind of life away from your real life, which is really sad. I came out in 2014 and I've always said the reason I came out in 2014 was because that was when I felt comfortable and I accepted myself for who I was. Before that, I still wasn't entirely comfortable with being gay. You know, it took a long time for me to feel comfortable in my own skin. But when I decided, like, right, yeah, I don't care what people think, I don't care what people say, I'm ready to do this. And if this industry and sport and football in particular is going to change, it needs people to come out. It needs people to take those first few steps so that other people have people to look at and be inspired by and see, oh yeah, it's not too bad, is it? Yeah, things are okay. Things are changing. So yeah, came out in a magazine in 2014, told everyone, social media, big hullabaloo. I think, you know, would I say it was the best decision I've ever made for my career? Probably not. Was there a lot of challenges at the beginning? Definitely. Did I progress and overcome them and feel more comfortable in my skin? Absolutely. Was it the right thing to do for me personally, my mental health, my mental well-being, and for the people around me? Definitely. And even now, you know, 8 years later, I still get messages from people that say, oh, you know, you've really inspired me and you've really helped me feel comfortable in my skin. And it always still humbles me and touches me now because I didn't come out for a young kid that would read my story 7 years later. I didn't come out for anyone else. I just came out to try and make my life a better place. But in doing so, you realize that you're having a huge impact on so many LGBTQ plus people around the country. And I always felt like if one person felt like they could live their life and go into football and work in the media and be gay because they've seen me doing it, then I would always feel like, well, that was worth it. That was the reason to come out because you've enhanced someone's life in a very small way. But a very poignant and meaningful way. So, it was one of those things. And like you say, there's been so much progress that's been made now. You know, we have LGBTQ plus programs, we have campaigns, we have Football versus Homophobia Month, we have the Rainbow Laces campaign. There is so much work and activism and education that's happening that I do think LGBTQ plus people do feel more comfortable going to football. They do feel more comfortable going to sport. You've got Josh Cavallo, you've got Jake Daniels, you've got Xander Murray, you've got high profile, you've got people that are out being their true selves, playing football, being involved in football. And yeah, it's cool. Is there going to be issues in the future? Of course there is. Are there still sexism, racism issues now? Yes, there is. But are we becoming a more understanding, educated society? Definitely. So, you know, this is a really positive moment and things are moving forward in the right way. So, yeah, it's funny, you know, it's it feels so free to talk about it now. You know, I said to me 10 years ago, you'll sit here and talk on a podcast or in an interview or on live TV about your sexuality and who you were and being gay in football. Not a chance. I would never feel that comfortable to do that. But yet now I'm sat here talking about it and embracing it. And, you know, I think if you are a happy, out, comfortable version of yourself, you will be a happy, brilliant version of yourself at work. And I think that's the most important thing for myself and everyone to take.
You talk about at work, so that's sort of the main phrase. When you first came out, did you feel like anything had changed, or was everyone perfectly happy and sort of just cracked on as it was? I mean, obviously a big change for you, having knowing that everyone knew, but everyone else around you was perfectly sort of welcoming and happy. Like, I think what I've read a lot about is people don't want things to change. You still want to be treated as Mark McAdam. Nothing's changed. Was that sort of how you felt?
Yeah, I felt, you know, that my colleagues were brilliant. I think for me, coming out as the first openly gay on-screen presenter and reporter at Sky, there was, you know, a little bit of nervousness from the bosses, because they'd never had to deal with that before. They never had someone that was out there talking about their sexuality and doing interviews with football players and football managers, you know, at the same time. So I think there was one of those things where this is a little bit different for us. This is, you know, we haven't had to do this before. We haven't had these conversations before. We don't understand it. This is all very new. So I do think it was, you know, it was challenging in different ways for everyone. But my colleagues were amazing. Generally, I think football was amazing. I felt the love and support from a lot of people. And, you know, these things always take time. You know, stuff's never going to be, you know, perfect all the way through. But I think that was, yeah, it was, you know, the most significant moment of my life. And the one thing I think as well that, you know, this is always a thing, you don't really ever just come out once. You know, no. You come out, it's not, you don't just come out and go, right, that's it, I'm out, and everyone knows now. Because you'll meet someone new 2 years down the line, you'll say, oh, you've got a wife, you've got kids. And then you have to have that conversation. Well, actually, no, I'm gay, so no wife, no kids, no. And then you meet someone else in the same conversation, oh, you know, and then you, no, I'm gay. And so you're always coming out for the rest of your life. And, you know, not everyone knows your backstory. Not everyone has read page 118 of Gay Times from 2014. September issue. So, you know, you have to kind of have that conversation with people a lot. And there's always that nervousness as well. When you meet someone for the first time, there's always that little thing in your mind and you go, oh, is this person going to be cool with me being gay? Do I just decide not to tell them, or do I just answer the question cleverly, or do I feel comfortable that I can be who I am? You know, 99 times out of 100, you feel comfortable to be yourself, and whatever someone thinks. So it's one of those situations. I always say you can never just come out at a certain time. You have to just come out when it's right. Yeah. If that's 57, 27, 12, or 21, you know when you're comfortable in your skin and when you're ready, and you're not working to anyone else's time scale. You're only working to your own, and you set that time scale. And if you want to come out, you come out. And if you don't and you're not ready, then you don't. It's as simple as that.
No, well, completely. Well, no, thank you very much, sort of just opening up and sort of chatting a little bit about it. I know you've chatted a lot about it in previous, but just sort of for me, having read a lot but never sort of like heard that much, is quite a powerful but also incredible thing to hear about. So sort of moving on from that and now looking at just a couple of like the main headlines moments. So obviously Premier League this year, one of the biggest headlines has been Erling Haaland. Sort of, freak, like, can he keep it up? Sort of, there's not really words to describe them, are there?
I love it. I think it's incredible. This is just what we love about football and sport, and we love those people that are brilliant, whether it's Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal, or whether it's Lewis Hamilton, or whether it's Phil Taylor or Tiger Woods, or Serena Williams. We love those people that are, you know, just freaks of human nature, because they are so good. Now, generally in football, you don't get very many of them. You know, Lionel Messi, Ronaldo, Pele, Zidane,
you know, those kind of players don't come along very often. They're once in a generation. And now you're looking at Erling Haaland, who has scored against every side he's faced in the Premier League this season, except for Bournemouth, I might just add. He just looks incredible. He is the complete package of a striker. Physical presence, strong in the air, quick, dynamic, brilliant ability to find space, scores with virtually every touch.
Not tonight.
Intelligence, sorry?
Didn't score tonight.
Did he not? I haven't seen the results tonight, so I don't
know.
But he's one of those, you know, he looks like he's going to get 40 to 50 goals this season, which would just be remarkable for his first season in English football. There's been some brilliant stats banded around over the last 24 hours that he would have to score an average of 37 goals for the next 17 years to get on the same level as Ronaldo. So, yeah.
And Ronaldo's not allowed to score another goal for that to happen as well.
Yeah. So, you'd look at that and think, that's how good Ronaldo is.
Yeah.
But also, you do look at him and think he could be that man, could go on and get a significant amount of goals. And, you know, we'll leave Man City in the next two or three years and end up playing for Real Madrid or Barcelona. And then he'll move on and go and play for Bayern Munich and then he'll, or Borussia Dortmund again. And then he'll, you know, and so on and so forth. So, I think he's incredible. Absolutely. Yeah, he's one of those players that you have to say, you have to go and watch him play because he is that good. You know, like Messi and Ronaldo, you always remember when you watch them live. And he's a really, really special, exciting player.
Have you had the pleasure of meeting him yet?
Not yet, no. But I'd love to.
It'll come.
22 years old. It's not like he's 27. Like he is still at the beginning. He has got so much more improvement to happen and so many more levels to his game. So yeah, I cannot wait to see how he unfolds as a player.
I think the fact he's been even put in the same conversation as sort of people drawing out the facts of how he can match Ronaldo sort of illustrates already how incredible he is. And City are unstoppable if he keeps up what he's doing. But do you think he is one of you talked about him going in 3 years to Madrid, then to Bayern? Do you think he is one of those players who will keep dotting around to whoever's got the most money?
I don't think it's about money.
Whoever can afford to have him.
I don't think, you know, Man City paid £51 million for him.
Yeah.
You know, that wasn't a £200 million deal. It was a £51 million deal because the clause that was inserted into his Borussia Dortmund contract was in the summer of 2022, he can leave for €65 million. Mm. So it was quite simple. That was that. And I would be pretty certain that that clause exists in some form or another at Manchester City.
Yeah.
Now, whether it's the summer of 2024 or the summer of 2025, probably a little bit more than £65 million, maybe £100 million, whatever it will be cheap. Mm-hmm. And it won't be about him going for the most money. It will be about him going to where he feels his career can go to the next level. You know, when you look back on your career, he probably wants to look back and go, right, I won titles in Germany. I won titles in England. I won Champions Leagues in various countries. I won this. I won that. I won all these things. And I played for five of the biggest clubs in world football in my career. So therefore I can go, right, I've done it all, I've experienced it all, and I've had the most incredible career. So I think it will just be about where he feels the next level to his game will come. You probably look and go, well, it'll be Real Madrid or Barcelona. So, and they can probably both, you know, afford the money and they'll both pay him, you know, big chunky wages. So I think it's only a matter of time before he leaves Manchester City. I think the Pep Guardiola thing was the biggest reason he decided to go there. The fact that his dad played for the club as well, definitely a big factor. But the fact that he could work under, you know, the greatest modern coach that football has ever seen and arguably manager, maybe in 10 years' time, he'll match the great Sir Alex Ferguson for titles and silverware. That would have been a big draw as well. But I cannot wait to see how he develops, you know. And like you say, we're talking now, he didn't score tonight. Wow, he didn't score tonight. You know, that's big news because you expect him to score at least one or seven goals every game he plays.
I mean, let's then look away from City, the team everyone sort of expected to be not neck and neck, but the main challenge is Liverpool. What's gone wrong there? Have you got any, not insight, but any thoughts on what the hell's happened there?
Yeah, I don't, you know, I think if I knew what had happened at Liverpool, Jurgen Klopp might pick up the phone and give me a job. I don't even think Jurgen Klopp knows what's going wrong at Liverpool right now. Clearly, there's something not quite right. There's something not happening the way it should. I think it also shows how much of football is a confidence and a self-belief game as well. When you're on that positive run, you're in the right place, and you know, I've seen teams that are really struggling with fitness. They're struggling with quality, but because they've got a belief that they can win games, they just go and win games, and they just keep riding that confidence wave. And clearly at Liverpool at the moment, it's just not there. So it might take some time for it to get back. You saw a few years ago where they had a bit of a struggle. They went into the transfer window, bought Virgil van Dijk and Alisson. This might be a moment where they go, right, we just need to freshen up this team. And now we need to do it. And you almost got the feeling as well that this summer you were looking at Chelsea spending 300 million, Manchester United spending 200 plus million, Manchester City bringing in Haaland, Alvarez, Phillips. You're thinking, wow, they're getting stronger. And Liverpool signed Nunez, which was great, but then they signed two youngsters. So you're thinking, well, I don't know if they've quite gone to that next level with everyone else. You know, Jude Bellingham would be the one player you'd look at and go, he's got the natural Liverpool fit. They could do with him right now. You know, imagine Jude Bellingham in that Liverpool side alongside Diaz and Salah and Nunez. You'd think, well, that's a, you know, a big player that can play there and take them to the next level. But they didn't spend the money. They didn't go and recruit the player they needed. And it almost felt like that side needed freshening up and it didn't get the big freshen up it needed. And now they're suffering. Two wins in 10 Premier League matches. They're closer to the bottom three than they are the top of the table. So therefore, this is going to be Jurgen Klopp's biggest challenge now. Interestingly as well, we had a stat on today's show. He was at Mainz for 7 years as manager. He was at Borussia Dortmund for 7 years as manager. Yeah. He's now been at Liverpool for 7 years as manager. Is it the seven-year itch? Is he thinking, you know, my time's gone? And, you know, as we've seen in football, you know, that how many team talks can you deliver? You know, when you've been there for 7 years and delivered in excess of 350 team talks and 350 half-time team talks, and you know, training session after training session after training session, the message gets stale. The voice gets repetitive. The energy isn't the same, and that's the challenge of football. When you look at the likes of Arsene Wenger or Pep Guardiola or Sir Alex Ferguson, how can you keep reinventing yourself and rejuvenating yourself to continually pull new things out of the same team? And that's what Jurgen Klopp has now got to do. No question, one of the greatest managers to grace the Premier League. But he's got a big challenge on his hands now because he's got to turn a ship that's heading in completely the wrong direction around.
Do you think that's going to cost him in the pursuit of Bellingham? Because Bellingham's not going to want to come to a club who potentially might not even have Champions League football next year. They didn't go and spend the money this year because it was all going to happen next summer, but they might have now missed the chance.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, Jude Bellingham might get an offer from Manchester City or Manchester United or Chelsea or Real Madrid or Barcelona. And you know, the offer might be, you know, more than what Liverpool are prepared to pay him. And the transfer fee might be more than what Liverpool are prepared to pay Borussia Dortmund as well. So, it's one of those bizarre moments where you think sometimes if you don't go and get a player, then you might miss out on a player. I was at Jude Bellingham's debut away at Portsmouth for Birmingham. And straight away, same as Harvey Elliott, you look at him, you think, oh, great player, so much ability, looks really good. You know, it was a lot of money for Borussia Dortmund to pay, Birmingham, £25 million for a young kid who's barely played any first team games. But actually now, £25 million looks like a steal. So, you know, That's football, that's recruitment, that's scouting. And sometimes it's not necessarily about, you know, it's about the club that's prepared to take the gamble. Every signing is a gamble. But sometimes you just have to look at it and think, well, actually, I think this is a gamble worth taking.
And there's been a lot of rumours sort of floating around about Mbappe, especially today and yesterday, about how he's sort of unhappy at PSG, but then they sort of said they'll let him go, but it's not going to Madrid. Do you see any like genuinity in those rumours? And if he does leave and he can't go to Real Madrid, where do you see him going? Because surely City can't then go for Mbappe as well, having already signed Haaland. Like, then there's, if you think right now, Bayern's probably the only other big club at the moment who he probably would go to.
Yeah, well, you know, clearly Mbappe stayed because he got the best offer from PSG and the most money from PSG. You know, I think he had his heart set on going to Real Madrid and everyone thought he was going to Real Madrid. He was on a free transfer and the deal was done. And then he stayed for whatever reason. So, you know, he must have bought into the project, or did he just buy into a great big check? I don't know. Check. Yeah, so, you know, all, you know, if he was unsure about the PSG project, just sign a year. You know, just sign a year contract and then leave again on a free in the summer. You know, it really disappoints me when players sign 3, 4, 5, 7 year contracts and then they want to leave after 18 months.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't work like that. You know, you sign the contract because you want to stay at that club for that period of time and get that amount of money. If you're thinking about leaving, then sign a shorter deal and back yourself. And back yourself to go and move on and get another club. But often players want to have their cake and eat it. They want to have all the money now and the security of a contract, but they also want to leave. Well, you can't really have both. And you saw it last summer with Harry Kane and Manchester City. And, you know, what happens if Man City did pay the 150 million that Tottenham reportedly wanted? Would they have gone and got Haaland as well this summer? Or would he have ended up going somewhere else? It's amazing how these things work out. But yeah, Daniel Levy said, no, you're not for sale. This is it. I don't care what gentleman's agreement you think we have. We're not prepared to sell you to a rival for anything less than this. And in the end, the deal didn't happen. Harry Kane had a long-term contract. He'd signed that contract. He had no choice. He had to stay. So players need to be conscious of those deals when they sign them. And you know, if they've got plans to move on, then don't sign the deal.
Mm. Completely. I mean, Tottenham will be rubbing their hands together now with Kane sort of hitting form that he's sort of looked like Harry Kane from 2 or 3 years ago, where he is just looking like he's going to score with every touch he gets. I mean, obviously not with the same proficiency that Haaland's got at the moment, but it's not far off. He's number two in the Golden Boot race. And obviously one of the sort of looking slightly less positive side of Premier League, there's two managers in particular who are very much under pressure, Steven Gerrard being one of them. Do you think that it's Villa worth sticking with him? He's obviously quite new to the whole managerial game, did well with Rangers, but otherwise pretty much unproven. Villa really struggling for results, even though they've spent the money. What do you think sort of the stories there is?
I think Steven Gerrard is clearly under pressure. I think he started to lose the fan base a little bit. I don't think there's that relationship there that perhaps there once was. I think the players need to step up, stand up and perform. But I do feel like the next six games for Steven Gerrard are going to be crucial. I think, you know, they're unbeaten in four matches. They've had decent numbers in terms of, you know, possession statistics and opportunities. Biggest problem recently, 3 goals in their last 4 games. So they need to start scoring goals. And those players up front need to stand up and be counted, because otherwise Steven Gerrard might find himself out of work. So I think the Aston Villa stories are really interesting to watch between now and the World Cup, because we know that the board have huge aspirations. They've invested heavily. They want to not just get into the top 10 in the Premier League. They want to be knocking on the door of Europe. And right now they're very, very far away from that. So yeah, it will definitely be an interesting one to see how they react and what happens with this Aston Villa team over the next few weeks.
Completely, yeah. I think he's got to turn it around pretty quickly, otherwise he will be in trouble, especially with they have backed him the money and they've brought in the players, and I mean, nothing's really come of it. It all looked so positive at the end of last season, it's just sort of gone downhill. If you think about the last day of last season when they almost spoiled City's party for Liverpool, and then, yeah, well, nothing's happened since, really. Well, Mark, I can't thank you enough for giving up your evening and coming to speak to us. I thought we'd finish with just a bit of a quick fire round. So I'm going to ask you a couple of things and I just want you to answer as truthfully and honest as you can.
Okay.
Start with favourite stadium.
Oh, wow. Favourite stadium. I love going to Fratton Park. I think the fans are incredible. And the noise that they create is brilliant. The Emirates is good. St James's Park as well is another one that is truly magical in so many ways. And Anfield as well. I know this is supposed to be quickfire, and I've given you four stadiums. So yeah, I'll stick with the South Coast, and I'll say Fratton Park's always special there.
Best fans.
Newcastle fans are hugely, hugely passionate, and I love their enthusiasm, excitement, and buzz for this current team and this project that they are just embarking upon. So, yeah, I'll go with Newcastle fans.
Newcastle is looking extremely promising, exciting. I think they will be a force to reckon with. Look at me, I'm now getting away from quickfire. Messi or Ronaldo?
I will say Ronaldo. Because I just think he's done it in more countries. He's been successful in different countries. He's taken average teams to glory almost single-handedly. The only time you can judge this debate is when they have both hung up their boots. You know, Ronaldo, whilst he's not playing very well at the moment, could go over to the MLS, win a couple of titles there, score another 80 goals in two seasons, and then suddenly the dynamic of his figures look even a bit different, and he wins a bit more silverware, and he keeps going and does really well, and suddenly you think, well, hang on a second, you know, he's still got it. Messi could decide to retire this summer. Messi, I've said it for the last couple of years, but I wouldn't be surprised if Messi finished up in the MLS as well. So he could just do one season and finish. He could do six seasons and finish. He could end up back at Barcelona. Who knows?
Premier League or FA Cup?
Premier League.
Klopp or Pep?
Pep.
Champions League or World Cup?
World Cup.
Yeah, I was surprised you were thinking about that one. Favourite player right now?
Favourite player right now?
To watch.
Favourite player right now? Wow. This is supposed to be quick fun. I'm struggling with this.
This is the last one, so take your time.
I'm trying to think of my favourite player. Who do I watch right now? I tell you, I'm going to change the question a little bit.
Go for it.
Favourite players that I've watched.
Okay.
I've always loved Lee Trundle. I know that's a bit left field, but Lee was one of those players I totally loved watching. I used to get excited when I went to a Swansea or a Bristol City game when he was playing, because he was one of my favourite players to ever watch. So that's a slightly tweak to the question, but a very non-obvious answer.
Who's your favourite Bournemouth player right now? Let's go for that.
My favourite Bournemouth player right now would have to be... I'm trying to think of who I might bump into first. Junior Stanislas.
Nice.
Yeah, gifted technically, brilliant player, responsible for some amazing moments, been hugely unlucky with injuries, and he got me two tickets for the Leicester game for my brother last week, so I have to say him.
There you go. Well, Mark, thank you so much. That's been, I mean, I've loved that, so thank you so much, yeah, for giving up your evening. I mean, I've learned a lot, we've had some fun, but yeah, no, that was great.
My pleasure, Freddie.
Awesome, mate. Thanks. Take it easy.
Top man. I'll see you soon. Thanks so much.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply.